who many of you know and needs no introduction, but I'll run through a little bit of information anyway. He's been an ARSC member since 1986 and has presented widely at ARSC conferences and other conferences related to audio archives. He studied electronics and since then has become a patent professional, and he's been an accredited European patent attorney since 1989. Between 1981 and 1987, George was funded by the Danish equivalent of the NEH for a project entitled Establishment of Objective Criteria for Correct Reproduction of Historical Sound Recordings. And he was also the head of the Section for Sound and Film Media at the School of Conservation in Copenhagen from 1991 to 1998. Apart from owning a firm of patent attorneys, he is now a private consultant in audiovisual archiving matters and conservation philosophy. He's published widely, including in the ARSC Journal, the YASA Journal, and in the AES reprints. This afternoon, he'll be speaking on Dayton Miller, an early person who is working with acoustical recording theories. And as always, we welcome George to the podium for his insightful comments. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I have this test chart because we need to be objective, and it is nice to see that for once when we have sound and image together, it's the image that suffers. The resolution is not worth talking about. Anyway, embarking on the analysis of the scientific approaches of one individual, that is Dayton C. Miller, really requires you to fit him in the picture to see the contribution in the context of the work of others. However, to be complete, this would go far beyond what we can cover today, where we are dealing with Dayton C. Miller's experience in sound recording. But we do need a bit of background to see where he deviated from the state of the art when he started. Incidentally, this is a part of the development of sound recording that is not at all covered by Jonathan Stern in The Audible Past. I think it's fair to mention because he otherwise seems so complete. First of all, at the point in time where Miller started the use of slow, laborious measurements and calculations based on registrations of sound was well underway. That had started in 1857 when Léon Scott de Martinville was able to obtain a scratched trace that was derived from a natural sound occurring in air on a blackened drum, soot, in fact. Physicians and physiologists jumped on the invention and tried to extract knowledge about such complex matters as the structure of vowels. When Edison had demonstrated his tinfoil phonograph in 1877, the scientific community was ripe and reacted instantly with experiments that used the tracings on the tinfoil, with the extra advantage that once a measuring microscope had determined the measurements of the indentations, the original tinfoil could be played back to make sure that the sound recorded was actually the sound they had wanted to analyze. If you had done it the other way around, you would have partly erased, and destroyed the tracings. That is why it was important to measure beforehand. It would, when Bell and Tainter and later Edison brought out the wax cylinder, another burst of activity occurred. This was the fledgling science of experimental phonetics. Now, simultaneously, with all sorts of objectivistic research went on in order to establish the performance of the animal and human body, such as velocity and force of the limbs, and that was taken up by so-called experimental psychology, which was trying to determine the control of mind over matter, to be crude, that is, the stimulus that caused a movement. Among the many that worked in this field, I'm going to focus on Edward Wheeler Scripture, who lived from 1864 to 1945, because he was the only one to write extensively on the use of sound recordings. He wrote a book called Elements of Experimental Phonetics in 1903. He was the big animal in experimental psychology, at Yale, and he made the most wonderful apparatus to convert the undulating grooves of cylinders and gramophone records into tracings that he would later analyze. And we'll see if this works. Yes. Here you will see an image of Scripture's apparatus. Maybe I can coax this one into... Yes, it will provide a little dot. Now, you concentrate on that one. Oh, which one? Here we are. No, here we were. There we are. The disc, it says disc here. And that is his major turntable. And we see it from above here. And what he in effect does is to take the modulations, which are of course radial, and convert them into a movement which is something like 4,000 times magnified, and put onto paper. Soot again used, tracings on paper. And so he got curves. And he realized that it was extremely important to have curves with sufficient amplitude. If you look at a gramophone record, so he says, in the microscope, you won't see very much modulation because it's all very low key. The timeline is too long. So he needed to amplify to get larger modulations. Ideally, what you want is something that goes at about 45 degrees when it goes upwards and then 45 degrees when it goes down, and so on, instead of being either very straight up or very flat, as on the record. And he did that, and it worked fine. Now, from his writings, it appears that he was not happy with mathematics. He was much happier with observation and recognition of waveforms, and his results are rather more qualitative than quantitative. But he did feel competent to pronounce himself on the structure of vowels. Even as late as 1933, he published, and he was much happier using feature indicators than formal physical measurements. But by then, he had moved quite away from this and into speech impediments. Stuttering and things like that were his field. Now, from the side of the physicist or astronomer comes Dayton Clarence Miller, who was born 1866 and who died in 1941. He had been active in early X-ray experiments. He had made a roadshow of X-ray experiments here in Cleveland and elsewhere, would demonstrate his hand or other parts of the body on X-ray, exposing himself, basically. And he was instrumental in important experiments on ether drift. I mean, Cleveland was the center of this. Michelson was the first professor at Case Institute of Technology. And Michelson and Morley made ether drift experiments, and Morley and Miller did the same. And then he was musically very, very skilled and interested in flutes. We'll see his portrait. This is a portrait he would have liked, because it shows him... I won't talk about that image. I have a beautiful image in front of me. You'll have to imagine it. All right. Now, in 1901, as far as I can see from his registrations of flutes, he started building his own flutes according to the designs of Theobald Böhm, who died in 1881. And by his own words, he became interested in the best material for a flute. In other words, where does the energy go when the flute is played? If it all goes into the tube, you don't hear what you ought to hear. In 1914, Miller stated, "The question of the influence of the material of which the body tube of a flute is made has not been settled after more than 70 years of widespread discussion. How does the tone from a gold or silver flute differ from that of a wooden flute? It was this specific question that suggested the investigations which, having passed much beyond the original inquiry, have furnished the material upon which this course of lectures is based." The course of lectures were the Lowell lectures held in 1914. Now, if we look closely, or reread it, you can read it in the book, The Science of Musical Sounds, where the lectures are represented, reproduced with all images. If you read that passage again, very carefully, having passed much beyond the original inquiry, I would say is the understatement of a century of musical acoustics, because he basically founded the objective measurement methods. In order to compare flutes, he needed precise measurements of energy radiated versus frequency. There was nothing in the contemporary literature that would help him, and I fancy that the works of scripture may actually have irritated him. There's no doubt he knew about them. Miller was very fortunate to be a physics professor at the Case School of Applied Science because they were in the process of outfitting their new physical laboratory, donated and named after Rockefeller. And he had a good grasp of mathematics, and he was able to specify and also perform fine mechanical work himself. In order to obtain the most up-to-date apparatus for Case, he traveled to Europe in 1896 and in 1900, where in Paris he met Rudolf Koenig from 1832 to 1901, a really famous instrument maker. And he had been the foremost instrument maker in the field of acoustics since 1862. He also stole Leon Scott's invention and produced an apparatus, but probably didn't pay proper license fees to Leon Scott. In 1905, Miller went back to Europe and made lectures and bought equipment. Now, we should see some of the equipment. Some of you may see some of it. It's the lecture hall, the old physics lecture hall at Case. And you will see some organ pipes in the background. Some tall structures are special kinds of organ pipes. And then you see something which is incredibly interesting to me coming from Denmark. It wasn't until the 1950s that we had that sort of auditorium with one armrest and a plate for putting the paper on. We never had that before, and you've had it since 1904. It's impressive. Now, there is no doubt that the precision of Koenig's instruments and the scientific insights that he possessed impressed Miller deeply, and he must have felt support for his urge to combine music and science. His first publication in this field was a translation and annotation of Böhm's German original to the flute and flute playing, which came out in 1908, was revised 1922. And from then on, there was nothing stopping him. First of all, he must have trusted his own ears when he disbelieved the following statements made by Scripture in 1906. Scripture said, "These experiments are, I believe, sufficient to do away with the notion that the vibrations of such diaphragms," that is, soundbox diaphragms, "have any resemblance to those plates that produce the Chladni figures. The thesis maintained," that is, by Scripture, "are, one, that the diaphragms bend concentrically around the center, two, that the nodal lines are present only as disturbing factors, and this to a small degree, or not at all." However, Scripture is quite prophetic, and he probably didn't know about it to know that he was prophetic, but he said, "A further investigation might have important results in producing better telephone diaphragms, as well as better talking machines, but the matter must be left to physicists, as it leads rather aside from the more strictly phonetic problems." Miller, the physicist, set about to determine in quantitative terms the influence of the horn and diaphragm on the recorded sound. And for this, he needed precise recordings that would be useful for mathematical, that is, Fourier analysis. He decided to record photographically on moving film a thin pencil of light made to deflect by the minute movements of a very, very small mirror that was rocked back and forth in direct consequence of the displacement of a diaphragm. His instrument, he called it the phonodyke, but it was actually Compton, who coined the phrase, it seems. But never mind, phonodyke. Yes. Here we see the components of the phonodyke, and we'll see. Now, that's a horn. This drawing is a standard drawing from his text, from his textbook, from Science of Musical Sounds. I'm sorry, I'm not getting a continuous wave here, but but I've added the horn. The sound box itself is very, very similar to the Edison design with the internal cone here. The diaphragm virtually the same diameter as Edison, but that only was found out after very, very much experimentation. 1997, I made a paper at the Audio Engineering Society, and the preprint was made. And in that, I've shown the nodal lines and things that scripture couldn't find. I have identified them, but I've left it out here because we don't have all that much time. Anyway, the diaphragm pulls on a string. There's a bit of rubber at the other end of the string. And in between, the string makes a loop around a pulley, and a minute pulley. The pulley, on the shaft of the pulley, there is a mirror, a small mirror. And a light ray goes into it, it gets deflected by the mirror, and thrown out through a projection lens onto either a screen, a much better one than this one, or a photographic film. He used 4 grams, typically, of tension on the diaphragm. Edison used 17 grams, half an ounce. That's what he writes in some of his notes. We'll have a close-up of the little pulley, and with the string going across, and you will see, those who know about watchmaking, that these are so-called jeweled bearings, just as you know it in a good watch. And the mirror is the hatched bar we see. We see the edge of the mirror here. Yeah, that's the edge of the mirror. And it gets turned back and forth when this little pulley is rotated back and forth by pulling the wire or the string. Right. He did not trust his horn diaphragm combination to give a correct representation of the sound pressure or sound energy, another expression, available to the mouth of the recording horn. He needed a calibration of his apparatus, or if that were not possible, at least a measurement of its transfer function to obtain a calibration curve. Miller obtained the services of an organ builder and had a set of chromatically arranged, equally strong organ pipes covering almost 7 octaves. Now, why is my... We'll see them. I can find my papers. Now, this is only... this is only 5... This is only 5 octaves we see here, so it's 61 pipes in total. Actually, his complete range was from 129 hertz to 12,400. And what he had, since he had semitones, he had 12th octave resolution, rather than third as we know it, but it's 12th octave. And that is pretty good. It's 6% resolution. It was very good for his time. Now, he preferred his organ pipes to be wooden stopped pipes because they had few overtones. The open ones had more, but that means distortion, basically. He wanted purity of frequency, and so he used stopped pipes. Now, with this information, he would be able to correct his measurements on the obtained photographic traces to eliminate the influence of the horn-diaphragm combination. And from 1909 to 1916, he published the results of this very fundamental research. Now, let's see one example. Here, his film is not moving. He doesn't want to make a continuous trace, but he wants to have the width, or the length of each line. The length of each line corresponds to the excursions, maximum excursions either side, of the mirror when that is sounded. And you can see that some frequencies are not represented very well, and some frequencies are represented, you could say, too much. So for each frequency, he just moved the film and let the next vertical trace take place, move again, next vertical trace. Then he connected the tops here to each other and obtained a curve. That curve is the bottom curve. And the top curve is the reciprocal of the bottom curve, so that he gets a correction curve. Now, he was not using logarithmic or decibel scale for his amplitude. He used a linear scale. And that is why you will see something like that peak here in the correction curve being derived from something which looked like rather a flat thing. If we took the trouble to particular up here, you see, that thing here means that you have to divide, you have to multiply by a very small factor in this spot when you have these large enlargements here. That if we were to do it on a decibel scale, we would see that they would be perfect mirror images, just like pre-emphasis versus de-emphasis. Now, here we have an interesting thing, because he wanted to be absolutely certain that he could rely on his results. And so he took a correction curve. That was on August 5th, 1911. Then he completely dismantled his phonodyke, put it back together again, and on August the 8th, he took the next one. And there is not a material difference between the two. And this, I mean, there is one. That seems quite notable, because that is quite different. But apart from that, he was very satisfied. He called it constancy of the correction curve, and there's no doubt that it was better than the general measurement possibilities in acoustics at the time. Now, Miller concluded the following on the performance of the horn in his original presentation in 1911. You want a long, straight taper, a length corresponding to a fundamental lower than the lowest tone being studied, solid walls, no holes, joints, or leaks, or else the tone with a note at the hole will be absent. Miller now applied his now very precise measurements to the study of tones from musical instruments, speech, and eventually the sounds of large guns. And in 1914, he effectively ends any real argument with scripture that I may have imagined with these words: "The results of the work here described are in entire agreement with Helmholtz's theory, and they are, therefore, out of harmony with Scripture's arguments." No more. The study of the characteristics of the various musical instruments was very labor-intensive, and he took between 500 and 1,000 curves for each instrument, requiring a man-year to distill. Fortunately, it was a school where you had students who would do work, and who were interested, but still it's virtually unimaginable in our days, where we do these analyses on computers and they come out 50 milliseconds after they are put in. Now, until now, we have only looked at what may be found out from Miller's published books, in particular The Science of Musical Sounds, came out in 1916, was reprinted with even the slightest corrections in 1922. However, in his laboratory at Case, he also undertook various consulting activities, and those are the things we need to look at now. Miller's office, nice office, you see, it's got all the essentials. It's for a musical man. You will see that it has a piano. It's an Ampico type thing, so it can reproduce. And he also got a gramophone. You call them phonographs, but that's all right. And I mean, all the usual implements and so on. This he was the head of the laboratory. One part of the work was the issuance of certificates regarding the quality of tuning forks from a number of US manufacturers. Until then, only European tuning forks had been good enough for public use, but he could prove that the US ones were good. He had a piano room in which he made research, because one part of the work was, another was the quality of piano tone for the Aeolian Company. In 1912, important people from Aeolian came to visit in Cleveland and visited him, and they made a contract by which he should research the tone quality of Aeolian pianos, grand pianos, and he did that. What is important here is this vertical thing, which is a hammer device with a falling weight. His phonodyke is here, so it listens to what goes on, and the hammer, the way falling weight was to make the touch the same every time so that he could measure properly from a piano. And later, he was called on to consult on the quality of a number of gramophones. And that is, of course, a subject near to the heart of this audience. I'll show you the selection of gramophones he had in his lab when he was working on it. A completely unknown picture. You really have to dig deep. And he hasn't published. That's the frustrating thing, but we'll talk about that. Now, some of you, I will show those who are interested in machines, I'll show close-ups, mostly two at a time. So here we see a Sonora on the left and a Aeolian Vocalion on the right. Here we see an Edison and a Victor on the right. Here we see a Sonora, a smaller model. We see a Victor with outside horn there and on top, and we see another Aeolian Vocalion behind there, above the horn, the horn for the phonodike. And here we see there was a Columbia Graphonola. Now, you can't read it, but it is there, I promise you. And here we have a small suite of records. Now, the photographs are so good that you can see that this one is a Victor record 10-inch, this is a Victor record 12-inch, and here you can't see a thing, except the reflection in the lid. What does that tell you up here? Pardon? I didn't say aluminum. No, what does this tell you? It tells you Columbia, because it's a tricolor Columbia label you see reflected up here. So he had put a Columbia record on there, and you see the stripes up here. Now, and interestingly enough, look at that. What do you see? A US phonograph, thank you. So he had a local phonograph in with his equipment, but we don't know how he rated it, because I haven't found any trace of his written reports in this field. So, now that is quite exciting. I would say that no doubt machine collectors would be able to tell us precisely what they are and perhaps provide a precise earliest date. That would, I think, would be an interesting complement to this. In 1915, he was able to conclude that the Aeolian Vocalion gramophone was superior to that of their competitors. In 1915. I don't know what happened later. And he was, about 1920, he consulted to the Brunswick Bolk Colander Company on the acoustic properties of horns for talking machines made of various materials and of various sizes and shapes. Here we see a gramophone in front of the phonodike. Here we see a close-up. It's a Victor gramophone. And I have focused on the horn because I'm not a machine collector, but I thought somebody could tell me about it at some stage. If we go in and look at that, what it says is Music Master, as far as I can see, or perhaps Music Caster, but I think it is Music Master. Okay. Well, it was... All right, okay. Yeah, well, I'm happy to hear that. But what is then this sound box? Is that an exhibition? Uh-huh. That's what I thought I could see as well. So he had an exhibition sound box, and he had this after-sales foreign horn on his, non-Victor horn on his Victor gramophone.
What about that stylus?
I don't know. It could be an error in the photograph. I don't know who wants to play a record with a sausage. Right. Aha.
Unless that's just a spot.
Oh, that could be. That could be, yes. I agree. Could. Well, anyway, in 1923, late 1923, he reported on a series of investigations for Westinghouse. He was testing their early loudspeakers, comparing them to a Western Electric 10D and one radiola type, UZ1320. Now, here we have a room full of radios and amplifiers, and a lot of horns. These are all horn loudspeakers. I'm not going to get close on those, but it's just interesting that he was actually involved in acoustic measurements, even though his procedure was totally acoustic, it went on into the electrical age. He also tested a complete sound transmitting system from a condenser microphone via an amplifier and the appropriate loudspeaker. He found the Western Electric loudspeaker below standard, and the Radiola fared little better. He revisited the project half a year later and was able to conclude that the Westinghouse type FH was far better than any of the others, in particular in providing clarity in the low range. By fitting the horns removed from the driver directly to the calibrated phonodyke and using his set of calibrated organ pipes, he provided useful information that checked with the theory of the loudspeaker horn developed by Hanna and Sleepian. That was 1924. Miller experienced enormous trouble with a resonance at 1,035 hertz that he could not explain by his own apparatus. It was taken apart and reassembled, and new horns were made. In the end, he had to conclude that it was caused by the condenser microphone provided by Westinghouse, because the sound disappeared when he substituted a carbon granule microphone, which we would consider a step back again. Miller continued to be the big animal in musical acoustics, but he did not make any contributions except for some very important publications. He diversified into renewed study of ether drift and acoustics lost. He was a founding member of the Acoustical Society of America, and he served a term as president, and he had many honors bestowed upon him. In the Dayton C. Miller collection at the Library of Congress, I have seen a graph he made of his annual acquisition of flutes for his collection, and that really took off in 1923. I believe that could have been the Westinghouse contract that gave him money for that. And in 1939, it numbered about 1,375. The whole collection, all the documentation, and a substantial sum of $10,000 were bequeathed to the Library of Congress, and a lot of the information from that collection is now available on the web. Miller had at his disposal at Case some fine pieces of equipment that saved a lot of analysis time. I'm not going to show them, but I'll mention they were a harmonic analyzer and also a synthesizer that was built in-house. Always aware of good advertising, he analyzed the profile of a beautiful Cleveland residence, Miss Georgiana Martin of 11006 Superior Avenue, and he reconstituted the profile with the correct phase relationships between the components. This is, however, not the profile you will see here. The tracings are different from the sources, and we don't know who this one is. But what he did was that he regarded that as a complete oscillation, the one on the left. He found out that it was so that a factor times a sine of a particular angle, and these sines and factors up to 32 components were all added together to create the one on the other side. So he resynthesized what he had analyzed from the first one. And he thought that you might use a profile instead of fingerprinting to characterize people, so you would have a number or an expression describing identity, as it were. It was the study of Miller's work that originally brought me to Cleveland in 1983, where musical acoustics had continued under Miller's successor, Robert Shankland, and his successor in acoustics, Arthur Binade, whom I came to know personally, because he too had a deep fascination for Miller's approach. And it was Arthur Binet's widow, Virginia Belleville, who facilitated my access to some of the images you have seen today. And that concludes what I will have been given time for. Thank you very much.
We have about 8 minutes for questions, so feel free to ask George any questions you may have.
Yes?
The little organ pipes you have there, the last,
Well, I think the difference was in the inside, because they were made of wood, and wood of a certain thickness. And in the end, it wouldn't have it serve any useful purpose to change the external dimensions, just as long as the sounding length was the correct one. And also, there were tuning plugs. You noticed at the top, the rods. They were, yes.
Jim Powell here. In the picture that you had of the radio horn speakers.
Yes.
I believe the third one from the right, is called a balanced armature speaker. It was a predecessor to a moving coil type speaker.
Yes?
I just am pointing it out.
Okay.
Able to recognize
well,
that.
I mean, what the driving system behind the horn is it's important, but if Miller wasn't very much concerned with the distortion, a balanced armature speaker was a good compromise because it had two gaps, one being getting bigger and the other one getting smaller in the process, and so some of the errors would cancel out.
Yeah.
It was a different system, a predecessor historically, but just a different way of doing it. Moving coil had come 1920, I think, by Rice and Kellogg.
Yes.
Yes. Thank you. Yes? Kurt?
George, the research that was done on those phonographs, you said that the Aeolian machines were shown to have, and I'm not exactly sure what they were trying to show. Was it accuracy of tone? Was
yes,
that
yes,
the issue?
Yes, it was. It was quality of tone and trueness to the original.
I think, from my experience anyway, an Aeolian Vocalion phonograph would not compare, for instance, to a Victor, and especially not to any of those outside horn Victors, which were certainly much earlier than the other machines shown.
Yes.
And the fact that in the picture that you showed us, you had maybe one or two Victors and one or two of other things, but you had, what, half a dozen Aeolian Vocalions. It seems to me that research may have been a little slanted.
I think you're right. I mean, I think possibly what he did was to help them. Unfortunately, I haven't found any report that directly describes this. I found reports concerning his loudspeaker work, but not reports concerning his gramophone work. And perhaps he just helped them identify which of the models they should go with, really. I don't know, Sonora, is that in any way related to Aeolian Vocalion?
No.
So at least there were almost as many Sonoras as there were. So perhaps Aeolian Vocalion said, look, our fiercest competitors in this market segment are Sonoras. Would you please compare those? I don't know them. I only know about his research because it comes from in-house physics laboratory reports. What have we done this year? But the results themselves are the property of the Aeolian Vocalion Company, and I don't know who has them now. Yes, Bill?
I know that you've done.
I said.
Oh,
this is Mike. Mike. Yes, yes.
I know that you've done research yourself on the horn resonances of recording horns, but it seems like that he's doing. If he's playing back records to be the device which he's measuring the phonographs from, that the resonances that are built into the records are certainly going to affect his. His results, but you have no way of knowing that because of the
No. You see, he was well aware of that, and we can see that from his loudspeaker measurements, because there he took the horns off their drivers and put the horns on his phonodyke, and subjected them to a well-known set of sounds and recorded that, so he could separate the horn from the driver, so to speak. And I'm quite certain that he did basically the same thing because he was comparing the output sounds of various phonographs with he knew the composition of the real sounds. He knew what a violin tone looked like. He knew what an A on a clarinet looked like and things like that. And when he could then compare live recording with record recording, and he could correct his apparatus for his own internal distortions in the apparatus, but of course not the distortions in the acoustic recording process. But the inspiration for me in my work was that here was a man who said, well, we have it's a linear distortion, but we have an uneven frequency response, and we can compensate that perfectly by opposing it by de-emphasizing what has been emphasized.
Well, do you think that any of the record companies, because most of those phonographs were made by companies that also made records, did they actually do that? Did they actually make records that would be the opposite in resonances of their phonographs?
Well, there was one company that did it, but that was only because they had, and we are now getting out of Miller because he wasn't involved. Victor recorded at 76 and told people to reproduce these recordings at 78. And I have maintained that there are some of these resonances that are both sharp and identical at recording and reproduction, because there are certain dimensions you cannot really go beyond, so to speak. You want to keep your sound passages short. That gives a high resonance frequency and so on. And by removing the two speeds, you would not let your reproducer being excited by what was already too excited on the record. So you had a broader sound, and they discovered it by the wear. The wear of the record was reduced when you did this, and the general public didn't notice. So you could say that some compensation was taking place, although it was in a most nasty way, in my view.
Yeah, this would be a scientific way of doing it.
Miller's curve would be scientific, and we would maintain the tuning and the speed. Yes, now Bill.
Well, thanks for sharing those pictures. It was great to see the things that went beyond the science of musical sounds. Even though I went to that school, I never saw those, so thanks for bringing them. And the small footnote is that U.S. Phonograph is their banner model, and it was first commercialized in May 1910. Others can tell you about the Victors and Sonoras.
Yes,
perhaps.
Yes. All right. Thank you.
We're about out of time,
mm-hmm.
But thank you, George.
You're welcome. We need to pull something. We can pull some of these things away from it. It can stay if it doesn't disturb anybody. Let it be there.
Okay.